Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
Okay, well, let's play a little game. Close your eyes and capture the very first image that comes into your mind when I say this word, Jesus. Now, what did you see? What did you capture? What did you see at that very moment? Maybe it was a picture like that Warner Solomon classic, The Head of Christ. Maybe something very serene like that. Perhaps an image found in one of those Sunday school picture books of Jesus walking down the road with a lamb by his side or something like that. Or maybe it was the disturbing form of an agonized Jesus found on many a crucifix. Popular images of Jesus vary, and the picture we have of him matters, as our chats with Michael Frost over the next few weeks is actually going to show. Michael is the director of the Tinsley Institute in Sydney, a training centre for pastors and missionaries, and the latest of his many books is called Re-Jesus, A Wild Messiah for a Missional Church. It's co-authored with Alan Hirsch. He believes we need to restore a true understanding of the life, message and mission of Jesus to our lives and churches, and over the next few weeks I'm hoping that's exactly what we might just do. Michael, welcome.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the new book, number 29 or something now, isn't it?
It feels like number 29, but no, I've lost count. I don't know how many is. It's a handful, that's for sure.
I know another author who actually chooses not to count the number of books that he does, so he doesn't fall into pride.
Oh, is that right? I think the Talmud says that every man should plant one tree, have one child, and write one book. So I don't know how you're going on that count.
I've done a couple of one and very few of the other. What was the earliest image that you had personally of Jesus?
Well, I didn't grow up in a church-going family. I grew up in a kind of a lapsed Catholic family. So, I feel like Jesus might have haunted our family home, but we never went to church by the stage I was old enough to be even thinking about those sorts of things. So probably the earliest image was that my mother kept by the side of her bed her first Holy Communion Bible. It was a white leather-bound Bible in a King James version. So I remember looking at the font. It was so tiny and in such old-fashioned language. I wasn't even sure it was actually English as a kid, just flicking through the pages. But it had a number of what were called colour plates, these big, hard, heavy images throughout the Bible. I remember sitting on the edge of the bed and looking at these, and it was Ruth and Naomi and Daniel in the lion's den, all those sorts of things. But right at the beginning of the Bible, there was Jesus the Good Shepherd. And I remember looking at this at great length. I was quite fascinated by it, trying to work out why this guy was the big deal that he obviously was, because that's what the book was all about, wasn't it? And Jesus the Good Shepherd had a flowing white robe and long sort of blow-dried hair and a very, very neatly clipped red beard and piercing, intense blue eyes. And he was reaching over a storm-swept cliff face to rescue a sort of a pathetic lamb that was perched on the edge of the rocks.
White skin probably as well.
Well, yeah, he probably was. With the square jaw, the classic, you talk about the head of Christ, that classic image of Jesus. He looks quite feminine with the long hair parted down the middle and curled at the edges. And so it would have been that sort of a face on this sort of quite feminine, I guess, flowing robes. You know, I didn't know many people when I was a kid who wore flowing robes. So you could imagine, I got the impression he was a very intense, surreal kind of person. Certainly didn't appear to me to be the sort of person that you would approach or hang out with. There was a magical, almost supernatural kind of element to this person. Now, I approached that image without having read the Bible or ever gone to church, so I was just making up what this might be all about.
And when you started reading the Bible for yourself, when you came to faith, did you take that image and kind of project it onto the pages of Scripture as you read the life of Jesus?
Well, we're going back a while now, so I'm not sure about that. Maybe I did. But see, like a lot of new Christians, I was in my teens, I got told to read Mark's Gospel, I think because they all figure it's the shortest and easiest to read. And it is the shortest, but I'll tell you what, it's not easy to read. I mean, Mark's Gospel, all hell is breaking loose in Mark's Gospel. I mean, you know, I challenge you, just read Mark's Gospel through in one sitting to rediscover it. I mean, there are people possessed by demons, every sickness you can imagine, thousands of people pressing forward because they're hungry. He's feeding them. He's escaping on boats. He's telling people, don't say this. They're going off and saying it. I mean, it is literally an image of chaos. and Jesus in the midst of all of this having absolute authority. And that was just so unlike this sort of serene Jesus rescuing the lost lamb that, yeah, I just did my head in. I thought, well, hang on, that image is surely not the guy here that kind of sallies forth and engages with the poorest of the poor, the sickest of the sick, the most oppressed, struggling, broken people. He simply walks through and brings colour and light and calm and health and food and nourishment and teaching. I mean, it's action-packed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like too many of the serene Jesus images that we have.
Mm. So you've written this book, Re-Jesus, with the idea that, yeah, we need to re-Jesus, for those of us of faith, re-Jesus our churches, our lives, our ideas of who Jesus is. When did you realize, actually, that kind of early experience that you had when you first looked at your mum's Bible was actually something much broader, that we as Christians, the church, actually often have those kinds of cliched images of who Jesus is?
Oh, well, I suppose. I mean, you know, when I became a Christian from no church background. So going into church and being very excited about a newfound faith, you know, you just figure, well, these guys are the experts. They know what church and worship services and church ministries should be like. I remember just thinking, oh, well, I go along. This is how it's meant to be. But yeah, the more and more I read the Gospels and then compared them with what I was seeing in church, I just thought, well, this is not the image that I get. I mean, I think Jesus would be overturning the pews and getting up to all sorts of trouble. And yet here it seemed, in the church context, there was a sort of a valuing of niceness and of order and of calmness and of being well-behaved. Well, I don't know whether Jesus was too many of those things at all, actually. Mm. I mean, it seems quite disorderly what happens around Jesus. Now, he brings a great sense of authority. He brings a calmness, if you like, insofar as he's in control of things. But he very often stirs up a whole lot of issues as well.
And picking up stones to throw at him.
Yeah, well, that's right. And, I mean, he's conscious that he kind of creates trouble as well. He recognises, I even might set family members against family members because of their allegiance or otherwise to me. I mean, my big question was this, you know, would Jesus qualify as a member in a lot of these churches that I was part of?
Yeah. This is Open House right across the nation. Michael Frost is with us. The latest book is Re-Jesus, A Wild Messiah for a Missional Church. And we're talking about images of Jesus and how we need to kind of have them recalibrated to actually the picture of Jesus we find in the biblical portrayals of his life. You actually have a number of, fairly tongue-in-cheek at sometimes, different kind of caricatures of Jesus that we can hold in our mind's eye. It'd be really valuable for us to touch on these because I think a lot of us actually hold to either one or a number of these images. Number one, the bearded lady Jesus.
Well, the bearded lady Jesus is similar to what we were just referring to, you know, the long-haired, square-jawed, sort of soft blue-eyed Jesus. And I understand where those images originally came from. I mean, they're attempting to show us a man who looks different to any other man, because Jesus is different to any other man. So I understand the motivation, but what we've ended up with is this highly feminized image of Jesus' face. I think there's an attempt there to kind of get at the gentle Jesus and the caring or compassionate Jesus. So in a sense, it's a little bit sexist. It's kind of suggesting, well, if you want to have a sensitive image of Jesus, we need to make him look like a woman with a beard, as distinct from what he probably did look like, which was, you know, a first century Jew growing up in Nazareth. I mean, he would have looked probably more like a 9/11 terrorist than he does like a bearded lady.
Mm, interesting, isn't it? Darker skin, crazy hair, thicker features, thicker nose.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the images that we have in the book is the BBC Jesus, and they took a first century skull from Palestine. So they're not suggesting this is Jesus. They just took the skull and they did that CSI thing with the plasticine to create what would the face of this skull look like. So it's basically, it's a first century Palestinian man, and a very thick neck, very round nose, heavy brow, olive skin, darker complexion, curly dark hair. We don't like that Jesus. I don't find that Jesus in too many stained glass images or too many pictures in art galleries. I mean, we really do not like the Middle Eastern Jesus. Mm. Certainly here in the West we don't. And so the bearded lady, you know, the feminized soft Jesus, that well, maybe not so much now, but that has held sway for a very long time in the church's imagination. Yeah. And the reason why we talk about these images is not so much that you've got to get an accurate, literal image of what Jesus would look like. We say that, you know, the way you picture Jesus actually has a strong bearing on your response to him.
Number two is spooky Jesus. And this is kind of the, you see a lot of these kind of sacred heart ones where maybe there's a little heart just over where Jesus' actual heart would be, and it's glowing and he's got the halo and things like that.
Yeah, there's some freaky ones, particularly, say, from the Middle Ages on. And again, just as the bearded lady Jesus is an attempt to sort of show Jesus compassion and gentleness, these are trying to show Jesus divinity. Yes. They're trying to say, well, look, he's not just any man, he's God. And so what do we do? How do we show that? And so there's halos and there's funny hand signals and there's exposed hearts. And now, you know, I understand, as I said, what they're trying to do. But very often what these images do for modern-day viewers is that they seem to repel us. It's a little bit like, well, if the bearded lady Jesus is just a little bit too soft for me, the spooky Jesus is like, well, I can adore that Jesus or worship that Jesus or be in awe of that Jesus, but I can't be friends with that Jesus. I can't be in league with that Jesus. He's not even of the same order of the stuff of me. So, well, I guess the way we put it in the book is that's a Jesus you can worship, but it's not necessarily a Jesus you can follow. Mm-hmm. And the fact was that the real Jesus gathered around him some very rough and ready people, some real outcasts, some of the most surprising and ordinary kinds of people. They were drawn to him. They didn't all stand back in shock. I mean, they wanted to be with him. And those spooky Jesus images don't convey that at all.
Yes. Number three, the ordinary Galilean Jesus, the Jesus of the, I guess, contemporary critical scholarship, the John Spongs and the Barbara Thierings and the Jesus Seminar critics and all of those kinds of people.
Yeah, yeah. And again, well, we mentioned the BBC Jesus before. There's a little bit of that in the BBC.
The historical Jesus.
Yeah, let's get back. There he was. He's an ordinary Galilean bloke. He just looks like a typical Middle Eastern guy does today. But again, there's a danger about that. Well, there's something good about
it. Going the other way, really, from the last one, isn't it?
There is something good about, let's get back to the fact that God put on skin and he looked like an ordinary bloke, and prostitutes and tax collectors and fishermen and impressionable young men and all sorts of people all threw their lot in with him. He must have been an extraordinary person, but not so bizarre or frightening as to repel everybody. Mm. So in that respect, it's helpful. But some of the scholarship you talk about, some of the more liberal kind of scholarship, which is just saying, well, basically, you know, Jesus just taught really nice things about, you know, loving your neighbour and caring for people who are in need, and you know, he's a great guru, a great teacher. But again, if you go back and read the Gospels, and we've been talking about Mark's Gospel a bit here. I mean, Mark's Gospel, there isn't a lot of teaching in the Gospel. There is, of course, but there isn't the Sermon on the Mount or those kinds of things. What there is demons getting driven out left, right and center, and small amounts of food feeding thousands and thousands of people. And I mean, to totally gut the story of all the miraculous and inexplicable things doesn't leave you with the same Jesus that Mark was wanting to commend to you.
So we've got bearded lady Jesus, spooky Jesus, ordinary Galilean Jesus, revolutionary Jesus, you actually add there as well, a kind of Che Guevara Jesus, the radical political Jesus. Where does he fall down, do you think?
Well, I am inclined toward the revolutionary Jesus if we don't see him just in purely political terms. I mean, Jesus was quite revolutionary within his socio-political, but particularly socio-religious framework. I mean, it was religious leaders that wanted him dead. And you only ever really want revolutionaries dead. You don't want, you know, gurus or lovely teachers about love and grace dead. You're happy for them to do whatever they want to do. But people who are actually pulling at the foundations of the whole system, those people are incredibly dangerous. And if you read the Gospels, you'll know it was the religious leaders of the time who worked Jesus out first, actually, not necessarily his disciples. They knew, wait a second, if everyone gets hold of what this Jesus guy is talking about, our livelihoods, our system, the whole thing comes tumbling down. So I do think he's revolutionary in that respect. but he's certainly not revolutionary in the classic political sense, like, say, Che Guevara or somebody like that. He's not wanting to usurp the political system, which happened to be an oppressive Roman regime, and establish the Jesus government and take over. But what he does do, interestingly enough, is he actually sows the seeds of the end of the Roman Empire in an interesting way. He doesn't attack the Roman Empire. He says, give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, and so on and so forth. But I think he knows if we unleash a whole bunch of people living like I live and have commanded people to live, and that takes root and becomes a wave right across the empire, it actually chips away at an empire that is oppressive and unconcerned about justice and has no interest in the poor or the needy or the marginalised. Slowly that system will be subverted. So I think he's subversive, most definitely.
Last one I wanted to add in there was one that you mentioned later on in the book is Buddy Jesus. And I actually think a lot of us, particularly maybe somebody from my background with a Protestant evangelical background in the faith, probably follow the Buddy Jesus. He's our mate. He's the guy we pat on the back. Even just saying that, I kind of have a bit of a shudder.
Yeah, yes. Well, I think you're probably right. And I mean, again, that's an emphasis on Jesus' love and his grace, that he's forgiving. And we love the stories about him taking the poorest of the poor, the woman who anoints his feet with oil, and she's rebuked by the religious leaders, but Jesus shows grace to her. He is her, you know, well, maybe not her buddy, but he is friendly and approachable. And there are a number of stories like that. But you've got to balance them against the fact that in the Gospels, Jesus often does his block at his disciples and often finds himself saying, oh, how much longer have I got to tell? How many times do I need to tell you this? I mean, there is something that is quite demanding of Jesus. So, yeah, he loves his disciples. But, yeah, he's not just a big ball of daddy love just there to compensate for your own family issues.
Michael Frost is with us, author of Read Jesus, A Wild Messiah for a Missional Church. We're doing a series on kind of our images of Jesus and then how we need to recalibrate our minds and our hearts around who the real Jesus of history is explored in the biblical account of his life and who Christians believe is actually alive today and can change your life in a spiritual way. Two things come into mind as we're talking. One is the first commandment, or the second commandment, actually, not to have any idols before God, the Lord our God. We find it in Exodus and the Old Testament passages. And I think then of people like J.I. Packer, and then also people, say, within the Orthodox religion, the Orthodox Church, the Eastern Orthodox Church, who actually wouldn't ever paint a picture of Jesus, wouldn't ever have an icon of Jesus or anything like that. And the idea is that we can't ever represent him fully. Is there something to that, do you think? Because we're never, ever going to get him right.
No, absolutely right. I think you are right. I probably wouldn't go so far as to say I think there's something sort of evil or wrong with a particular image or painting or drawing of Jesus, other than to say just what you said, and that is that no single image can ever do the trick. And when you think about it, no single image of any person can ever do the trick. I mean, I could see a photograph of you, Sheridan, and think, oh, well, I mean, I guess I can see what color eyes he has or what color hair he has or something like that. But I mean, what can I tell from this image about you? And if that's the case with us, how much more would it obviously be the case for someone as unique as Jesus? I wouldn't want your listeners to think that all we're talking about here is how appropriate are the images of Jesus that we've had throughout the ages. What I'm saying is that our preferred images actually probably tell us more about ourselves than they tell us about Jesus.
And that's where I wanted to go next. You also talk about in the book this conference that you speak at, and there's a worship leader there who leads the audience to, you know, really embrace the warm, loving Jesus. And you kind of get up afterwards and you talk about the wild, radical Jesus. And yet there was something in him, his own background, particularly with a very stern father, that actually helped to build that image as something that he really kind of needed. How do we recreate Jesus in our own image?
How do we do it? We do it sort of quite naturally because, well, we know that the Bible tells us that Jesus meets our deepest needs and longings. And so it can be very easy for us to allow those deep needs and longings to overwhelm our image of Jesus. I don't know if we mentioned this in the book or not, but I remember being in a Bible study and I'd written a book about grace. And I remember someone saying at this Bible study, oh, Mike, you know, I read your book about grace. I'm so with you on grace. Grace is the thing. Grace, grace. All Jesus ever talked about was grace, 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 grace. And I said, well, I mean, I did write the book about grace, so yeah, I'm with you on that. I said, but, I mean, that's not all he talked about. I mean, how do you cope with, you know, Jesus' parables about judgment? About a third of them are about impending judgment. Mm. And he said to me, well, what parables are they? And he was a guy who obviously his deepest need was sense of forgiveness and God's grace. Well, he just blotted out of his reading, in a sense, any of the times where Jesus was talking about impending judgment or judging others. And Jesus does do those mm-hmm. things. So we do allow Jesus to become captive to our own deepest needs. How do we get away from that? I mean, this is going to sound really basic, but it is about just going back to the Gospels, the original, most primitive, most basic record of the person of Jesus. We can't allow any stained glass image or any favourite picture in our picture Bible or any of that stuff to be in charge of how we see Jesus. Reread the whole story. Have a more fully orbed appreciation of the person of Jesus. Goodness me, Sheridan, I think actually the Gospels are the meat of what it is that we're on about. If we don't know the person of Jesus, how are we going to reflect him individually in our own lives or allow our church communities to be communal reflections of his character?
It's a bit of a shocking discovery for me about 7 or 8 years ago where I realised I knew more about the Apostle Paul than I knew about Jesus. Yeah, I'd read all the epistles. Maybe it's because they were so practical. They dealt with practical issues and realised, wow, I'm really unbalanced here.
Oh, look, I teach at a Bible college and it does amaze me how people will turn up and, I mean, they're good-hearted people and I'm not having a go at them. They love Jesus. But then when you ask them, when was the last time, you know, you read through the Gospels? And actually, I don't even just mean reading, you know, 4 or 5 verses, you know, because it will be good for you this morning. I mean, just yesterday, I think it was the day before, I took a group of my students and we just in one sitting out loud just read Mark's Gospel all the way through. And I said, what impressions did you have at the end of that? And all these things that they knew probably in the back of their minds, and they're certainly all there in the Gospel, but was impressed upon them again through the whole sweep of the story, not just a few sections here or there. So I know it sounds very twee and very kind of not terribly sophisticated, but I just say, go back to the source. I mean, the first followers of Jesus put enormous trust in those 4 Gospels. They believed them to be true. They believed them to be reliable. These are the kind of the core documents that make up the Christian movement. So I say, you know, sidestep your stained glass window or the colour plates in your mum's Bible and go back to the original source.
Plenty to think on. And this time next week, we'll look at how a radical rediscovery of Jesus changes how we see God, the church and the world. So I think we're in for a whole heap of reorganised thoughts and feelings and things over the next few weeks. Michael, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Good to have you with us. Michael Frost, the director of Sydney's Tinsley Institute and author of Re-Jesus, A Wild Messiah for a Missional Church.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.